you. This is the 57th New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our speaker for this session is Brother John Launchbury, and his topic is To Theophilus. This is the first talk in his series, and his title for today is Paul Before Caesar. Thanks, Brother John.
Well, good morning, everyone. I like the energy. That's great. Well, it's great to be here. This has been a few years in happening, this Bible school, as Brother David said last night, but it's delightful to be amongst you. So I used to be a university professor, and I'm afraid this is a little bit of a university professor kind of series of classes. So, you know, time to gear up, you know, put yourself back in a university frame of mind, school frame of mind. We're going to look at the letters to Theophilus. I remember when I first of all discovered that my nicely bound Bible wasn't how it started out. Like, Jesus never had a Bible like I had. It sort of felt to me as if the Bible had always been that way, and yet in Jesus' time, he didn't have the New Testament because it hadn't been written yet. And the Old Testament, he would have to go to a synagogue, and they would have the scrolls, and they would read parts of it. And it was really clear that they're separate. Here's the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. Here's the scroll of the prophet Jeremiah, and so on, all these holy writings. And I think sometimes it's valuable to think about the Bible that way, to think about it back in terms of its original pieces that we have very conveniently all nicely bound together. And in that context, it's really valuable to think about the Bible of how it came to be, like who wrote it and what was their motivation in writing it. Why do we have it at all? I just realized I wanted to set something up here. So my thought is that if we have a better grasp on the intentions of the original writer, then we have a better chance of hearing the real message and not misunderstanding it, not misapplying it. And so what we're going to be doing is exploring the dynamics of Luke's contribution to this body of writing that we have, that we call Scripture or the Bible, that we'll explore the dynamics of Luke's contribution to Scripture as he is writing it. So let's start out with just the beginning of Luke. First of all, Luke wrote two of our books in the New Testament. Here's the first one. It starts out this way. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you've been taught. So there's the first one. The second one, Acts, he says, in my former book, Theophilus, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and to teach until the day he was taken up to heaven after giving instructions through the Holy Spirit to the apostles he had chosen. So it's a single two-volume work that we have. The claim is right there. And so Luke and Acts have got one author, two volumes, written to Theophilus. Now, it's a pity that our Bibles give them such different names and don't even place them together. I mean, if we followed the naming convention of other parts of the Bible, we might call them 1 Luke and 2 Luke, for example. Or if we did what we do with Paul's letters and name them after who they were sent to, we might call them 1 Theophilus and 2 Theophilus. But I guess that train left the station hundreds of years ago, and Luke and Acts it is. But sometimes for fun, we will use those names. We'll talk about the two volumes, or 1 Luke and 2 Luke, or we'll talk about 1 Theophilus and 2 Theophilus. But mostly, we'll just stick with the traditional names. So let's think about the content of these letters. Luke is intent on writing a careful historical account. And he builds a strong narrative arc with corroborating details. The first volume of Luke, the Gospel, traces Jesus from birth to death through to resurrection. And so it starts out in the temple, John the Baptist, Mary, the presentation of Jesus in the temple, the baptism by John the Baptist, the genealogy of Mary. That's the beginnings. He's laying the scene for who Jesus is. And then we start diving into the ministry, and this is like the body of the work now. Jesus, his healing, the debates that he has, the appointings of the apostles. We get a glimpse of his teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. He's commended by John the Baptist. I mean, you know the kind of content that we have there in the middle of Luke. And then he changes gear, and he starts looking at the culmination. We start getting Jesus talking about going to Jerusalem. There's the healing, there's the triumphant entry, cleansing of the temple. He talks about the nature of Messiah. There's the whole thing with Judas, the Passover, the arrest, the accusations from the Jewish authorities. And now he's on trial. Jesus is on trial. And we get the judgment. We get the judge speaking up. Pilate is there, the condemnation, the crucifixion, the burial, the resurrection, and the witnesses to the resurrection. Do you see how smooth that narrative arc is? It just takes the story from the beginning to its natural conclusion in the end. So now let's look at Acts through the same lens. This is the second volume of Luke, where we see a similar kind of pattern going on. We start out with the new beginnings. We've got Pentecost, the leadership by the apostles, all of the early work that's taking place. We're talking about now the first 8 or 9 chapters, dips into chapter 10 and so, including Stephen, the persecution, the conversion of Paul, Cornelius, Gentiles starting to come into the church. And now, in a similar way, Luke changes gear and starts to deal with the body of what he wants to talk about. And the body of Acts is about the ministry of Paul, what Paul is doing, how he's reaching out through the empire. It starts with him in Antioch. He's preaching in Galatia. He develops churches. There's tension as he goes on. There's Gentile issues that bubble over the council in Jerusalem. There's preaching as he starts moving to Greece. And then he starts talking about his impending imprisonment. And just like the first one, it's now going to be centered on Jerusalem. And he starts talking about, I have to go to Jerusalem, and I know that in Jerusalem I'm going to be arrested. And so now this last part of Acts is all about this journey to Jerusalem, going into the temple, the arrest that takes place in the temple. He's now on trial, and it's in one place, and then another, and then another. And now he's being transported to Rome. He's got to face trial in front of the emperor. And so he's taken to Rome. He's there in house arrest, awaiting trial in Rome. And we get to the end of Acts. I mean, it's shocking. This is the biggest question about the book of Acts. Why does Luke stop his second volume before he's completed this beautiful narrative arc that we see him do in the first volume? From historical documents, we know what happened next. We know what happened when Paul goes in front of Caesar. This is Caesar Nero, Emperor Nero. Actually, likely his representative, because we understand that Nero disliked the actual work of judging. But Paul goes in front of Caesar's representative, and he's acquitted and released, and then he carries on preaching. And he goes further west. He goes through Gaul, France, and then down into Spain. Clement, who was the leader in the Church of Rome, writes in his first letter in AD 96, Paul was herald in the west, and he had gone to the extremity of the west. And if you look at the Roman Empire, the extremity of the west is Spain. And in fact, this reflects exactly what Paul's intention had been in the letter that he wrote to the Romans in about 55 AD. He says this, I've been longing for many years to visit you. I plan to do so when I go to Spain. I hope to see you while passing through and have you assist me on my journey there after I've enjoyed your company for a while. So we know, even from Paul's own writing, that he had this intention to go to Spain. And Clement says, yeah, he went there. He went to the extremity of the West. In fact, if we look at other fragments of ancient writing, for example, Cyril of Jerusalem, writing somewhere in the 300s AD, says that Paul fully preached the gospel and instructed even imperial Rome and carried the earnestness of his preaching as far as Spain. So The implication of that is when we get to the end of Acts, where Paul is in Rome, Imperial Rome, doing his preaching, freely able to talk to whoever, that he's going to be acquitted, that he's going to be released. He's not going to be put to death, as is the penalty that he's facing. And he goes on and he carries on and he fulfills his desire and he goes on to Spain. So if even we know what happened, why doesn't Luke complete the story? Why does he leave his narrative arc unfinished? Well, some claim that there's narrative purpose in Luke stopping where he did. One person I've heard say, it's a victory of sorts. Here is Paul in Rome, the center of the empire, with freedom to preach. Yes, he has won. But that's not convincing. I mean, he's still under arrest. He's still facing trial. I mean, that would be like Jesus being hauled in front of Pilate, and we stop the story at that point. Like, we need to know what happened next. Some claim that Luke intended to write a third volume, another volume, and decided that he should stop this one here. But I mean, this is the mother of all cliffhangers. Like, why does he stop? It's not like he has to encourage his audience to come back next week for the next episode. It's very natural in that time to complete the story and then go on to the next one. Some even suggest that maybe he ran out of parchment and so had to stop there. But I don't find that convincing either. Here's another look at the two volumes, just to see again how surprising his abrupt ending is. Here's the first volume. In approximate proportions, Jesus' origins, the teachings, the final few weeks. The percentages are percentages of all of Luke's writings in here and Acts. And so if we add Acts to it, we get this kind of picture, the apostles and the inclusion of the Gentiles, Paul's expansion work, Paul's arrest. And so you'll notice that Luke has this big emphasis on Jesus' final few weeks and the completion of the story. And Acts also has a huge amount. 30% of Acts is just devoted to this whole motion to Jerusalem, the arrest, and then going on to Rome and the things that he's facing there. And in fact, if we take all of Paul, the 60% of Acts is about Paul. This is the point that Luke is making. This is the focus. Just like the focus of the gospel is on the last few weeks of Jesus' life, his death and resurrection and so on, so the focus of Acts is on the arrest and the trial, which makes his omission of the outcome even more significant. So here's the claim that we're going to be exploring over these six classes. The end point of Acts comes from the timing of when Luke was writing. It's not for any purpose of narrative or running out of parchment. We're going to claim that Luke finished writing at this point because he brought the thing up to the present day of when he was writing, and the document was needed for a particular purpose. That he's been writing for a purpose, and now he has to submit the document because it's today. Luke, when he's writing Acts, does not know what will happen to Paul. And in particular, here's the claim that Luke constructed these two volumes to provide a rigorous account of Christianity as a factual basis for Paul's defense as he faces trial in front of the court at Rome. So that's the claim. Sometimes at Bible school we hear interesting talks and maybe not quite sure what point the speaker is making. Here we're going to be really focused, like laser focused. We've got six classes making this point. I hear John Thomas was, or maybe Robert Roberts was once asked, you know, in a 20-minute exhortation, how many points should I make? Like three or four and like one, you know. And so I take that to extreme, you know, six classes. I'm going to make one point in six classes. That Luke constructed his two volumes to provide a rigorous account of Christianity, to provide a factual basis for Paul's defense as he faces charges before the court in Rome. And if this claim is true, I think it's very exciting. It's a very exciting idea, and there's lots and lots of implications of the idea. And it addresses some otherwise very puzzling issues that we face in Acts specifically, but also in the gospel. Now, as you think about this claim, with your years and years of Bible study, I'm sure there's already questions forming in your mind, like, what about this aspect? What about that aspect? I don't quite see how that would fit in. Here's my recommendation. Jot down any questions that you have at this point, and let's see if they get addressed as we go through. Six classes, we're going to have to address a lot of points. So it's written to Theophilus. Luke wrote to Theophilus. Who was he? The Greek, if you break this up, God, lover, Theophilus. A lot of people make a big deal about that, that he is lover of God, according to the meaning of his name. Chrysostom, around 400 AD, suggested it might be code for any Christian believer. But on the other hand, that's sort of like saying, if I say Southampton, that could be code for any village in the south of England. Like, I mean, it's that kind of reasoning, and I don't find that particularly compelling. But a lot of writers have been led astray by this suggestion that it is somebody who this is like a code name. Now, actually, Theophilus was a fairly common name. We know a bunch of Theophiluses. That sounds like something from Dr. Seuss, doesn't it? Theophiluses. We know a bunch of Theophiluses around. So there was a Greek geographer that a number of ancient writers referred to. There was an autocrat about around 90 BC called Theophilus. We even have his image on a coin. There was a high priest while Jesus was alive called Theophilus, not while Jesus was alive, I'm sorry, soon after the death of Jesus, called Theophilus ben Ananus. And so do you see my point? Theophilus is a pretty common name. And here, Theophilus, Theo there, if it had any meaning, it's almost certainly meaning one of the Roman gods, like Zeus. So it means lover of Zeus as opposed to lover of who we think of as God, because that's to the Romans who the Theos was. I say it's a common name. It's common in every sense of the word as well. We have some graffiti from Pompeii. As people have pulled away the ash, they've discovered graffiti. And it's a little crude, I'm afraid. Some street wall graffiti where there was some Theophilus in there. And the graffiti says, Theophilus, don't have sex against the city wall like a dog. I mean, the actual thing is even cruder than that. I paraphrased it to be polite. But here's my point. Theophilus was an everyday name. Lots of people were called Theophilus. And so it's a pretty common name. So what do we know about this Theophilus? Like, what could we deduce there? Well, the title that he's given is notable. This most excellent Theophilus is significant. If we look at all the uses of this title in the New Testament, turns out there are three more uses of it in the book of Acts. Here they are. So this is every use of this word in the New Testament. Claudius Lysias to His Excellency, Governor Felix, greetings. Everywhere and in every way, most excellent Felix, we acknowledge this with profound gratitude, says Paul. I am not insane, most excellent Festus, Paul replied. What I'm saying is true and reasonable. Do you notice a commonality between this? These are titles given, in these cases, to Roman governors. This isn't just a, you know, be polite kind of thing. Festus and Felix were Roman governors. They are very high stratum of society. The archaeologist Ramsey says this, the epithet Crotistus, most excellent, is technical and distinctive and not a mere thing commonly taken an appeal of men outstanding in dignity. Luke uses it strictly, implying equestrian rank. So there were five ranks of Roman citizens. In the first century, the highest rank was the senatorial class. They were called ordos, these ranks. The senatorial ordo was the highest rank, and it was very limited, about 300, 400 people, that kind of. The next rank below is the very honorable, the so-called equestrian rank, this rank here. And it corresponds to a knight of the British Empire kind of thing. It's Sir someone or other. So when he calls him Most Excellent Theophilus, he's actually calling him Sir Theophilus. That's kind of the name that he's being given. This is the class of person. Below this Sir class, this Most Excellent class, you then have the city rulership class, and then below that you have the army, and then below that you have the everyday Roman citizen. But in the context of the Roman Empire, to be a Roman citizen in the first century was a huge thing, even to have any one of those five. And it gave you tremendous rights, as we'll see as we go through this class. And so here's Luke writing to Sir Theophilus. It's the kind of rank of a governor or a senior civil servant. That's the kind of rank of person that we're talking to. And so I think we can conclude quite rigorously here that Sir Theophilus is a Roman government official of high rank, exceedingly high rank. So let's start thinking now about what Paul was doing with his appeal to Caesar. So I'd like to start talking about the nature of Roman law, and in particular, what happened with Caesar. So here's a picture of Julius Caesar. There's been some great reconstructions of pictures. Obviously, we don't have any color photographs of Caesar, but they've managed to take the images that we have and use AI to do colorization so that we get at least a pretty good idea of what these people might have looked like. So Rome started out actually with kings. We often don't think about that because that's way back in the very earliest days of Rome. And they decided they didn't like kings, they threw the kings out, and they established a republic. And so for the first few hundred years of Rome's life, as a nation, as an empire, it was a republic, and it was ruled by the senatorial class. The senators and their descendants and so on, the aristocrats, were the ones who ruled Rome. And as Rome started to expand, over time, it gradually took over Italy, and then it took over the neighboring areas, eventually taking over Greece, and then there were battles with North Africa, took over Egypt, down into Palestine, into Spain, kept battling with the Parthians, but it grew to the kind of extent that we often see in our maps today. So we had the Senate as ruling, but they also had elections. And those elections were the executives that would run things for a year. And so they'd have a couple of people who were in charge of day-to-day decisions. And in that context, over time, they developed a pretty strong legal system. It had this notion of a written law. There was a very early notion of the 12 tablets that stated various principles of law. And then they moved that into a set of stylized legal formulas. And so if you wanted to sue somebody because they took your cow or something like that, there was a particular formula you could use, and it would go in front of a judge, and the judge would decide. Julius Caesar upended the Republic. He was a popular politician and military commander. He had attacked in France and brought all of France, or Gaul as it was called in those days, under his control, even into Britain and establishing a presence in Britain. But he was facing significant legal difficulties at home. Kind of sounds familiar. And the likelihood of banishment, of being ejected from the empire. And so what he decided to do was gamble it all, and he brought his army into Italy. He crossed the Rubicon River. If you've ever heard that phrase, he's crossed the Rubicon, that's Julius Caesar, brought his army across the Rubicon River. It was now all in, like all his chips are on the table. And he comes down, and his army takes over Rome. Actually, with almost no bloodshed, because everyone knew that Caesar was marching on Rome, and so they legged it and got out of there. And so he kind of got in there, and he was able to establish himself. And then he started inviting people back, but now he's completely in control. And he won supreme power and did so through civil war in about 45 BC, so about 40 years before Jesus was born. And he got proclaimed dictator for life in 44 BC. So he was now going to be supreme ruler for the rest of his life. which turned out to be about 2 months, because in March of that year, various senators, you know, Brutus, Cassius, you know, et tu, Brute, all of that kind of stuff, as Shakespeare shares with us, assassinated him. And so suddenly he's dead. And so Rome gets immediately thrown into civil war. But what had happened was that Caesar had appointed young Octavian his heir. And so Octavian inherited everything from Caesar. And it took a few years for Octavian to actually gain full power again. There was a time where three of them, him and a couple of others, were ruling Rome. But gradually, he managed to sideline the others, and Mark Antony, the final one down in Egypt, until he became supreme authority. And he's often considered the first emperor. But really, it started with Julius Caesar. And what Augustus did was established his rulership. So Caesar had left behind this legacy of a supreme ruler. And from now, in the first century, until its collapse, Rome is going to be dominated by these emperor dictators. And Augustus, as I say, becomes the consolidates power. He still calls himself first citizen, you know, one of these euphemistic titles. I'm just one of you. I'm just the first citizen. But he's absolute ruler. And he passes many new laws, and he establishes the civil service to administer the empire. And in fact, he introduces new ways of doing law. But if you're trying to run an empire from Rome, and it's scattered right across the Mediterranean Sea, and it takes 3 months or 6 months to travel to another part, and they don't have telephones and things like that, I mean, how do you do that? Well, you have to do that by having representatives, governors, in each of the various parts who have a great amount of autonomy about how they carry things out, and you have to have a rigorous set of rules as to what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. And so that's what he does. He sets up this whole legal system, or refines the legal system that he inherited, so that he can effectively run this empire from Rome. So then... Jesus was born during his reign, as we know from the Gospels. He dies. His favorite heir that he was hoping to was Drusus, but Drusus also died. And so he had adopted Tiberius, and Tiberius then became emperor. And again, we read about Tiberius in the Gospels, and it's during the reign of Tiberius that Jesus is crucified. So Jesus lives in the reign of Augustus and Tiberius. And Tiberius became a truly perverted man. Was something of a recluse. Had people around where he was, and was it's hard to put into words the level of abuse and perversion that Tiberius underway. He was so hated that when he died, they didn't give him a burial. They just took him and threw him, his body into the river, into the Tiber with Tiberius was the cry they had. So he dies. Now who's going to be emperor? Well, Drusus has an heir, a very popular man called Germanicus, but he dies. And so his son, Caligula, ends up Tiberius had actually adopted him as heir, and so he's going to now become emperor. Tiberius was bad, and Caligula faced a lot of that evil in his young life and was completely distorted as a human being, like had no sense of how to behave in any way that was, he truly was the worst Roman emperor, and very young. He lasted just 4 years. It was a scary thing to try and kill the emperor, because you would get killed by the next emperor, because they can't let emperor killers go, right? Even if it was a bad emperor. But 4 years later, he got killed, and now suddenly you have the issue, like he doesn't have any children. He didn't adopt anybody. Who's going to be emperor? Well, it turns out that Germanicus has a brother, Uncle Claudius, And Uncle Claudius never was going to amount to anything in his life. He had a very bad speech impediment. His mother was embarrassed about him. They put him writing histories for a while, and then they didn't like the histories he wrote because they turned out to be too honest about the family and things like that. So in fact, when Claudius heard that Caligula had been murdered, he hid because he knew he was going to be next. And then the soldiers came in and they found him and proclaimed him emperor. I mean, nobody was more surprised than he was that he suddenly is emperor. And everyone's like, we never thought it could get worse than Caligula. Now we've got Uncle Claudius. Like, you know, how bad can it be, kind of thing. It actually makes, you know, today's politics seem quite reasonable. But it turned out that Claudius amazed everybody at how good he was. I mean, he was one of the great emperors. He radically expanded the civil service. He expanded, he established the government class, and put the government back on a really robust footing. So he's been around, and again, we read some of his things in the book of Acts when he expelled, for example, the Jews from Rome. Claudius ended up being poisoned, it seems like, by his niece, Agrippina, because she wanted her son, Nero, to be the next emperor. And in fact, Claudius had adopted Nero as his heir. And so if we now get rid of Claudius, now Nero will step in. And Nero was a very troubled man, never really wanted to rule. He came to the throne at age 16. He actually started out relatively well. He had great advisors around him, Seneca and Commander Burrus, the commander of the Praetorian Guard. And with that context of that sort of legal advice and governmental advice, he wanted to restore proper legal procedure and authority to the Senate. And you know, even though he really just wanted to be on the stage and play his lute and those kinds of things, he wanted everybody to praise him at how wonderful he was, which they did, of course. He nonetheless had the responsibility of command. And so his worst impulses were mostly restrained by his advisors until around 62 AD. Burrus dies and Seneca is banished. And so now he's on his own. And he's unrestrained and starts to get a little unhinged. And that's exactly around the time where Paul's trial is. So Paul is going to be facing trial in front of Emperor Nero. In fact, when Paul writes Romans, the letter to the Romans around AD 55, Nero is on the throne. So when he says submit to every governing authority, he's actually writing about Nero, ultimately, and those that Nero has put in place, which is kind of shocking. So Paul's trial is around this point. Just a bit before Nero is really getting unhinged. And he's about to get seriously unhinged. And many of you will be familiar that a fire broke out in Rome and Nero decided to blame the Christians. And then as part of the condemnation of the Christians, he wrapped our brothers and sisters up in tar and set fire to them, in skins and set the lions on them. I mean, it was just horrible. So much so that the historian Tacitus says that people started to feel sorry for the Christians, I mean, even for the Christians, because of the way that they were treated by Nero. So this is the context when Paul is appealing to Caesar. There's a legal system, I'm a Roman citizen with certain rights, and I'm going to use it to get in front of the emperor and be able to make the case. God has told me that this is what I want to do. So let's think about what he's going to face in terms of the kind of legal jeopardy that Paul is in. Roman law was actually built on fairly simple principles. The jurist Ulpianus in about 200 AD described it as follows, that the principles of Roman law are live honorably, don't harm one another, and render to each his own. That was the intent of Roman law, and all the rest was detail. So in the context of those kinds of principles, there are three criminal statutes or areas of criminal law that are going to be very relevant to us. The first one is treason, maestas. So maestas was anything that was subverting the empire in any way, like diminishing the majesty of the emperor, sedition. If you falsified government records, that was treasonous because you're perverting the empire in some way. If you falsely claimed citizenship, again. If you refused to swear by the emperor's spirit, that could be interpreted as a statement of treason. Treason was so serious that anybody could bring a charge of treason against anyone else. I mean, even women and slaves could bring charges of treason. Like, they weren't allowed other aspects of law, but they could bring charges of treason against anyone else. Viz was another area. Rome was actually trying to establish itself as a peaceful place because it wanted peace. Peace is a lot cheaper than war. And you get more taxes in time of peace than you do in time of war. So they wanted peace everywhere. Violence disrupted peace and taxes. So anything to do with violence, provoking violence, is something that they had very strict rules against, especially if that violence had seditious purposes. Violence actually even applied to government officials if they unfairly punished somebody. You're now using the state, the power of the state, to inflict violence on someone else. So it was one of the constraints against governors, for example, that unless they followed the law, they themselves could be at risk of vis. Rioting was another example of vis. And then there's a general area called collegia. We have the word college. People come together, collegial, when you get on well. Collegia was the idea of, there were associations. It started out as guilds, so you might have a blacksmith guild, you might have a farmer's guild, you know, all of these kinds of things. And the trouble with guilds is that they can be places where people have odd ideas, like overthrowing the local government or something like that. And so Augustus decided that there were certain guilds he was okay with, but he wasn't going to permit any more unless they asked for official permission. So you couldn't just form an association. You couldn't just choose to get together. So something like this would be illegal in Rome because we've decided to come together without official permission. So it's typically things like groups with shared funds, and it was a crime to come together to have an unauthorized association, especially if it was seditious or associated with violence. So here's the statutes, but they do have, in the context of these statutes, they have good legal process. Again, going back to our friend, the most excellent governor Festus, he says this: it's not the custom of the Romans to hand over anyone before the accused had met the accusers face to face and had been given an opportunity to make a defense against the charge. So this is what's going to happen with Paul. The accusers will have to be there. They will be the ones bringing the charge, and then Paul will have a chance to answer it. So in the context of these, it turns out that Judaism has a special place in Roman law. So we have collegia, these unauthorized associations, but Roman law, the background of Roman, the religious background, the social background, is that of paganism. And paganism, you can think of paganism as a big tent religion. Because what paganism says is there's all sorts of forces in the world out there. I have no idea how many there are, and so there's something in the river, and there's something in the city, and so on. And then there's these supreme forces in charge of them, and then Jupiter is in charge of all of those. And so it's no surprise then when Paul's in Athens that, you know, he discovers this to an unknown god, to an unknown force. Like, yeah, there's probably some other forces. We better make sure that we're worshiping to that one as well. So it was inclusive. But they had a suspicion about strange teachings. Here's how Sherwin White puts it in his 1960 lectures. He says, officially, the Roman citizen may not practice any alien cult that has not received the public sanction of the state. But by custom, he might do so as long as his cult did not otherwise offend against the laws and usages of Roman life, i.e. so long as it did not involve political or social crimes. The Julio-Claudian period, that is from Julius Caesar up to Nero, was characterized by general laxity towards foreign cults, which spread freely in Italy and Rome, but this laxity is occasionally interrupted by a sharp reversal of policy when the extravagances of particular sect call down a temporary and ill-enforced ban upon its activities. This is notable in connection with Druids, Magians, and devotees of Isis. So it's really interesting. Like, if you have your own religion, that's fine. You know, what you do in your private altar is up to you, kind of thing. Don't meet based on it. And it better not have any practices that we disapprove of. Druidism, for example, had human sacrifice. Big no-no in Roman law. And so they ruled it out. Magians, the Magi who came to visit Jesus, that was a cult which was frowned on, seriously frowned on by Rome. So new religions are mostly ignored so long as they're not too offensive, but they can't create regular meetings because that would be a recipe for subversion. So that's what's going on. But as I say, Judaism held a special place in Roman law, and this went back to Julius Caesar. He was fighting a battle in Egypt, in Alexandria, and some Jews there provided him significant help, and so he wanted to reward that military help that he did and that he received, and he established special dispensations for the Jews to practice their religion however they liked. And this got picked up by Augustus as well. Here's something that Josephus quotes in the time of Augustus. It's from a proconsul, Gaius Norbanus Flaccus, to the magistrates who are running Sardinia. Whoops. And he says, Caesar Augustus has written to me, ordering that the Jews shall not be prevented from gathering and from sending to Jerusalem monies, however much these monies may be, according to their ancestral custom. I write, therefore, to you that you may know that Caesar and I wish it to be so. So this has the force of law. Like, they have this freedom, and Caesar Augustus has just asserted it again. So this is how it has to be. You have to leave the Jews alone. Note the reference to not prevented from gathering. That meant that those practicing Judaism could gather for the purposes of their worship, even that they were now an approved organization. The Jews, however, went through a tough time under Caligula. He wanted to come down into the temple and force them to worship him, but he was killed before he did that. When Claudius was in power, he restored their rights. This is what Claudius writes. Tiberius Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, they have a lot of names in those days, high priest and tribune of the people, ordains thus. Caius, which was Caligula's popular name, out of his great madness, reduced the nation of the Jews very low because they would not transgress the religious worship of their country and call him a god. I will, therefore, that the nation of the Jews be not deprived of their rights and privileges on account of the madness of Caius, but that those rights and privileges which they formerly enjoyed be preserved to them that they may continue in their own customs. So that's a pretty powerful statement about the Jews. So that's not to say Claudius was entirely happy with how the Jews behaved. We know from Acts that he expelled them from Rome. Not entirely sure why, but I think it's important to note, and it will be important as we go through, to note that Judaism has special protections under Roman law. Okay, back to Paul. So this is the context, this is the legal context. What are the charges that Paul is facing? He's going to be going in front of the legal system. Well, as best as we can tell, Paul is charged with these specific activities. That one, his activities undermine Caesar and Caesar's representative authority, the temple, the Sanhedrin and all of that associated with that. So that's one. If found guilty of that, he's guilty of treason against the empire and its death. Charge number two, wherever he goes, he's provoking rioting and disorder across the empire. I mean, he goes to Thessalonica, there's a riot there. He goes to Berea, there's a riot there. He goes down to Corinth, there's rioting there. He goes to Athens, you know. You see the point that they're saying? Wherever he goes, there's rioting. So he's provoker of all this rioting. He comes to Jerusalem, and the whole temple area goes into a riot. So he's guilty of viz, is the charge. And these Christians meet together all the time, and they've not been authorized. And so he's guilty of collegia. So this, as I say, is as best as we can tell what Paul is charged with. But there is some difficulty to be fully sure. Even his early trial judges found it a little challenging. Again, our friend, the most excellent Festus, he pulls King Agrippa in and says, we need to listen to Paul, and this is the reason. He says, King Agrippa and all you who are present with us, you see this man. The whole Jewish community has petitioned me about him in Jerusalem and here in Caesarea, shouting that he ought not to live any longer. I found he had done nothing deserving of death, but because he made his appeal to the emperor, I decided to send him to Rome, but I have nothing definite to write to his majesty about him. Therefore, I have brought him before all of you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that as a result of this investigation, I may have something to write. For I think it's unreasonable to send a prisoner onto Rome without specifying the charges against him. Like, no kidding. So this is after Paul had been arrested and had been on trial, waiting for trial, for over 2 years in Caesarea. And the charges and the circumstances are still not quite clear. Now, under Roman law, Festus had the authority to release Paul, except he had already appealed to Caesar. He'd already appealed to the Supreme Court. And so even if he said, you're released, Paul might say, no, I need to clear my name. I need to go before Caesar. And so now he has to send him on, and he has to figure out what it looks like. So in order to prepare for a case before Nero, this is what will need to happen with Paul. As I say, there's been a long process of legal history, a legal due process, especially for Roman citizens. It started out being a private matter between individuals, one of them suing another, following these set formulae. But Augustus initiated a new process that for a long time ran in parallel with the old one, using the word cognitio, which means knowledge. Understand the act, and then see if it violates something on the statute. Look. And so the state now starts to become very heavily involved in administering the process and enforcing the process. So there's an accusation. It has to come from a private citizen. They didn't have state prosecutors in those days. It was coming from a private citizen. They had to make the accusation in writing. And they can compel witnesses to attend. I heard this person say this. I saw this person. They can force people to come and witness a trial. There is a principle of discovery where the plaintiff has to produce any copies of any evidentiary material. The defendants don't have to when they've got maybe defensive stuff, but the accuser has to. And it turns out that documentary evidence was regarded as of crucial importance, particularly certified copies of official documents. And that was much better than somebody just saying something. If you could find a document that had some mark of veracity about it. As a defendant, you didn't have to defend yourself. You could have a lawyer present who would do the defending for you. You can invite witnesses to attend, but you can't force them to, so you're a bit of a disadvantage there. But you can compel the government records. And sometimes there were advisory juries. It was going to be decided by the judge, but they might have advisors who listen to the evidence and decide. So in terms of the judge, in Latin, iudex, it's typically going to be the emperor or the emperor's representative or a governor. The governor can't appoint a representative when it's a capital offense. It has to be the governor themselves or the emperor's representative. So this is taken very seriously. This is at the highest level of government. The judge will have people that will help him decide how he's going to judge. So one is he'll have a group of people forming a consilium. And in that consilium, you can think of that as counselors. They're legal counselors who will tell him about, here's a statute from such and such, here's what somebody else says, and they'll bring the law to bear on how we can think about it. So they're the legal experts, and then you have people responsible for gathering evidence, the cognitionibus. And that office is responsible for supporting to the judge for gathering facts that are used at trial. So all of this evidence comes in. And you can see this is a significant process. It's not just turning up one day and saying, here's my side, here's your side, and those of you who are parents. I mean, it's a little more involved than that. There's one other role. There's this commentariensis, who's the sort of court clerk who's responsible for keeping all the documents, guarding all the documents, and supervising the prisoner. In Acts, we read about the centurion Julius, who is going with Jesus. Who's going with Paul on the journey. And it looks as though Julius is playing this role of the commentariensis, of making sure that the prisoner gets to the court and hears all the relevant documents. And in fact, maybe that was one of the reasons for the delay in Rome, because perhaps the documents were lost in the shipwreck, and so now you have to send back to Judea and get copies of the documents. So here's the context. I mean, there's a lot of facts there, and I'm sure it's starting to, glaze over a little bit. But I wanted to just give you a sense of it. Let's just review the things that we've said. Luke wrote two volumes. He finished his second volume at a strange place. You have to find an explanation for it. The explanation that I'm offering is that he was writing these volumes so that he could present them to Sir Theophilus in order to be there for evidence in Paul's trial at Rome. And this Roman procedure is a big procedure that will take a lot of work to prepare for it. So in that context, let's just read Luke's introduction again. This is a self-translation, a more literal translation of the opening of his two volumes. He says this: many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the matters that have been accomplished among us, even as they were delivered to us by the original eyewitnesses and officers of the account. After closely and accurately tracing everything again, step by step, I too decided to write for you, Sir Theophilus, so that you can be certain of the account you were told. So we learn a number of things immediately from that. First of all, Luke himself wasn't an eyewitness. He's more like an investigative reporter. He's going around and he's interviewing eyewitnesses, learning what they did, what they saw, and he's gathering all that information. And what he's trying to do is he's traced everything again step by step, and he wants to write this ordered account now so that when the Theophilus, who may well have been the official, the Roman official, who's tasked with assembling facts for Paul's trial, that he's been told, here's the summary, now here's the written evidence that he can refer to again and again as he's assembling the facts. So this word told, sometimes it's translated taught. The Greek word is related to our word for catechism, and it's got picked up in teaching, church teachings kind of thing. But actually the word is much more general than that. It shows up later on in Acts 21, when James comments on what the Jewish Christians had been told about Paul. Like, they've all been told stuff about you. So it's just talking about verbal information that has been conveyed. So, as I say, Theophilus may have been from the office of the Econitionibus. His purpose, he claims, is to provide a rigorous, documented account of everything that may be relevant. Luke knows that Theophilus has been given a verbal account. He's now providing a written account. Today, we might call that an amicus brief, or we might call it an affidavit. It's sort of somewhere in that space. Under Roman law, you were subject to perjury if you submitted something that was false. So this is going to be held to a very high standard. Luke is under himself. Luke is under the possible penalty of perjury if he puts anything false in these documents, which is why he's so rigorously going to be building them up. And this introduction to volume one is very formal, most excellent Theophilus. In volume two, it's much less formal, O Theophilus. The first account, O Theophilus, concerned everything Jesus began to do. And so this suggests that that Luke might have become actually familiar with Theophilus over this intervening time. Perhaps volume one was the first, one of the early interactions with him when he gives it to him, and now volume two, he's giving it. He's perhaps had many conversations. Okay, so we're going to stop now. Let's wrap up with a summary. So far, what we've learned. Acts has a strong focus on Paul, particularly on the circumstances of his arrest. Paul is headed to Caesar for trial, potentially facing a death sentence, likely facing a death sentence. Luke wrote the gospel as a two-volume affidavit that is going into the legal system. They were written to Theophilus, a high-ranking government official, and Paul's defense is going to have to be mounted in the context of the Roman legal system. And we will pick up looking at the defense tomorrow, all being well.